Welcome back to episode, was it 165? Yeah, 165.
165, Tim.
Okay, 165. So, Joe, well, tonight we decided to talk about the CDC. Before we get into that, maybe we can talk about a few updates. there's a COVID follies, as we're calling them, in Utah. Misdemeanor charges for not wearing masks in Utah schools enforceable for students and staff. K through 12 students and teachers in Utah now can be charged with a misdemeanor for not wearing a mask. Governor Gary Hubert issued an order on July 17th requiring masks on school property and buses. While Utah does not have a statewide mandate, all students, teachers, and staff and visitors are on school property must wear a mask. Interesting how these orders have replaced laws and legislation in our free country.
Hey, orders. Tim, I have a question.
Yeah.
If the kindergartner was convicted of the misdemeanor and sentenced to prison, how would he know the difference to his kindergartner?
I'm already in prison. What are you going to do?
He would think it's an upgrade.
Yeah, because prisoners have more rights, apparently.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
violating the order would be the same as violating any mandate. Any mandate. What's the lawful basis for these mandates? Well, I guess emergency, you know, which is a Class B misdemeanor that is punishable by a sentence up to 6 months in jail and a fine of $1,000, according to the Utah judiciary. Enforcing the mask mandate in schools is left up to local jurisdictions, officials said this week. The mask mandate is not intended to penalize students, parents, or teachers. It's intended to create a universal standard of safe, common sense practice. All mandates make a Class B misdemeanor the default penalty, but any enforcement of this would be on the local level, because they might not go that far. Ann Lenhart, Director of Communications for Hubert, said in a statement to CNN. Currently, Utah has at least 47,521 COVID cases, whatever that means. I guess test positive, not worth anything because those tests aren't reliable, and reported 377 deaths. According to a tally by Johns Hopkins University, I wonder how many of those deaths are comorbid, like with bus car accidents and motorcycle accidents. Now, of course, this idea that a mask will keep us safe and healthy is not based on any science or experience, empirical data or science or experience. As recent as 2018, a study showed that the constant or routine wearing a mask risks developing hypoxia, which can lead to blood clots. In May 2020, the CDC and the World Health Organization concluded masks are not effective to stop the transmission of influenza. How much more evidence do people need to stop wearing these things? Not to mention the fact that, you know, the constant fiddling the masks, there's no standard for masks, they just say masks. People will touch them, people will reuse them, they won't keep them clean. The mask itself becomes a very hospitable area for things like fungal infections and also staph infections and these things. And not to mention, again, the fact that they're inhibiting breathing. I was listening to a show out of Ireland, Computing Forever is the name of the show. And he was talking, the host was talking to a doctor in Ireland, and the doctor was talking about the planned reopening of schools this fall in Ireland and some of the restrictions that are being imposed on kids. And he was talking about the stress that parents, particularly mothers, have to go through as they get their kids ready to go to school. Make sure they got to wash their uniforms every day. They can't carry lunch boxes. If they have a cold, a slightest cold, they can't send them to school. These things. And one of the things is, of course, the mask wearing. They're going to require masks wearing all day in school. Of course, this is a problem because this is not only is it bad for their physical health, this is bad for their psychological well-being, this constant wearing a mask. But one of the school administrators announced that, you know, with this mask wearing, children will be granted what they call a breathing break. So that it's like a recess break where you can get out and breathe properly. So they're admitting that these masks are inhibiting breathing and the uptake of oxygen, which isn't good. But you're going to give kids a breathing break. How nice of them. That, of course, what that does is it obviously shows that they know that these masks that they're making people wear are not good for them. They have to take them off. And of course, when they're allowed to breathe, they'll be monitored and they'll be socially distanced and all that stuff. All this, mind you, for this, you know, for a flu virus or a cold, which is no more lethal than any typical flu with that. So yeah, you have that. But again, this, I think this mask wearing stuff is sort of a, I mean, it's a principle is being violated here. Bodily autonomy. This leads directly towards forced vaccination or highly incentivized vaccination, as the Australian health minister said. and also, it's a divide and conquer thing. You know, there's the mask people, and the non-mask people, and then they set to fighting each other, and it keeps them from focusing on who's doing this to them. And this is the kind of dialectic they're creating to, you know, divide and conquer us and impose the Great Reset. And as we've mentioned before, the masks are very important for creating, maintaining the narrative of the crisis, of the pandemic. So as long as people are wearing masks, it suggests that there's something out there that you're trying to defend yourself from, as opposed to the normal way that humanity has dealt with these things is there's literally trillions of viruses and microbes out there. We interact all the time. You can't wage war on germs. You have to live with them outside. You know, basic hygiene. This is ridiculous. It's actually a form of mental torture they're imposing on everybody. It's a no touch torture type strategy they're using on the public and creating a mass hysteria. You know, so and Chris,
that's certainly correct. I mean, they're taking away our self-esteem as they move forward with this process.
Did you mention something? What was it that they're making people wear, like dog? Was that like a cone on their face or something?
In Maine, when I first saw this and I saw a picture of the apparatus, I thought it was, you know, just humor, but it turned out to be correct. It's real. The governor of Maine, I think her last name is Mills, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's Mills. Yeah.
Masonic. Which she has mandated that food servers wear inverted cones. For example, like a dog who has had an operation on his hip, they'll put cones over its head so that it can't bite itself. And the idea is these cones will keep the breath, you know, deflected upward.
That's medieval.
Yeah. I mean, it is,
and that's that's an insult to medieval era because they built cathedrals. No, but I'm saying
you have to see photos of this to really get the absurdity. But there isn't any, of course, as in so many of the mandates, there's really no science whatsoever. Because I spent the week studying the EIS, you know, this this kind of CIA of the CDC. I was looking at some of the scientism that they were producing in terms of masks and all this stuff. And I got into some people who were describing the traveling power of the virus droplets, you know, the different things that come out of a cough. And if you had a mask on, it would simply deflect it up and then into the atmosphere and then onto the customer within a matter of minutes anyway. So it's completely absurd in terms of prevention, but in terms of, you know, reducing us to, in this case, not just on, you know, we're not capable to speak normally, but you can't even, we're invisible. We're just these cones that walk around the room.
Can you imagine like knocking each other's cones off or something?
Yeah. And you know, just think of like the people who are locked down in Melbourne and in Auckland. I'm sure there'll be incrementalism as what I call it, and they'll reduce it. They'll go from level 4 to 2 to 3, you know, they'll bounce around a bit over the next couple of months, but they'll keep introducing this kind of a phenomena, which is there to psychologically debase, because if they can hold us in place, you know, so that we're not ever fully released, they can just continue with one after another. You know, masks can become mandatory. Masks can become cones. You can easily imagine goggles, like Fauci had recommended. And now, when you've got your cone on and your mask on, I mean, all you need is a little cap with a propeller on the top of it.
Well,
Shouldn't be.
the propeller will keep the germs away as it spins.
Yeah. So it's a grim situation because they're making jokes at our expense. In studying the EIS, I wanted to mention a potential witticism, which is hard to get, but I wanted to just throw it out there because people can make some sense out of it. The head of the EIS, or the she, not sure she's the head, but she's the acting head. She's the one with the power. Her last name is Shochet. It's a Hebrew name, and I'm butchering it. It's very hard to pronounce. But she is the individual who actually was the basis for the character in the film Contagion. And she met with Kate Winslet to help her understand the complexities of this position. And her last name in Hebrew means ritual slaughterer. In other words, it's a name given to the person who would slaughter animals for kosher eating and also for sacrifices at the temple. And this struck me as they might have actually found this got something of a witticism if they, were looking at the CDC and particularly the EIS, which is supposed to help people be basically, something of a destroyer. Now, this may seem like far-fetched, but this humor, which, I can kind of see because I've written Caesar's Messiah and I kind of understand, I believe I do, some of the first century stuff. And I just to give a context to that last name, I'm not sure I've ever mentioned this before. It's the explanation of 911, which is also humor. And 911, or why 911 was selected for the event, is because of Tisha B'Av, which is the ninth day of the 11th month. The Hebrew calendar gives the day first and then the month. So 911, Tisha B'Av. That's how it's understood, and it's actually, if you go into sites that are produced in Israel, they'll refer to this date as Israel's 911 because that was the day that the temple was destroyed by the Romans. And moreover, there was also the day that the Babylonians, I believe it was, or perhaps I'm forgetting, maybe it wasn't, anyway, it was the first destruction of the temple was also on this date. So that when the Romans wrote the history of their destruction of the Jews in the first century, they wrote their history showing that it was kind of divine, and that's why they linked it back in time to the first destruction. As you know, we've had two temples. This was the second temple period. The third temple period is still to be seen. But anyway, so that was why that date was picked. I'm quite certain because I think it plays off of it's a way of vengeance against the Romans for, mocking them by saying that the second time the temple was destroyed was 911. And notice you have the three buildings, which, if they are in fact orchestrating this as a kind of symbolism against the Flavians, the Christian, excuse me, the Roman Caesars. There were three of them. There was, the father Vespasian, and then Titus and Domitian. And so the three buildings I've often wondered about because there were the three Caesars who were involved in the war. But anyway, sorry to be long-winded, but I think that the Tisha B'Av is a useful thing for people to be aware of because I think it's if you know the symbolism and the humor in Josephus, in that first century war, you can see that it's hard to imagine that 911 was just picked circumstantially. And just to show context, the burning of Notre Dame was on, I believe it was on Friday the 13th, and that was the day that the De Molay, who was the precursor of the Freemason. He was burned on the steps of Notre Dame on that date. and I forget what century even, but it was on Friday the 13th. So I think that was why they picked the day to burn Notre Dame. And then just finally, the bottom, you know, we talk about economic numbers. I mean, when the S&P hit the bottom, it was in 2012, it hit 666. And then a few years later, it had the flash crash, which was, they said it was 1,000 points, but actually it was 999. It was 999 points that was the round trip. And so I think that these numbers are in play, and I just point them out because I just think that could help people have context of what's going on today if they're aware that there can be a really dark kind of humor relating to dates and numbers and things. So be aware of that, you know, as you go through your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There's a court ruling in New Zealand. New Zealand's first lockdown ruled unlawful by country's high court. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern imposed New Zealand's first lockdown in March. New Zealand's high court has ruled the country's first nine-day COVID-19 lockdown from March 26th, April 3rd, was unlawful as it infringed on the people's rights and freedoms without legal basis. The High Court of New Zealand ruled on Wednesday that the country's stay-at-home orders under threat of punishment were in breach of civil liberties after lawyer Andrew Borodell launched a suit against the government in July. A panel of three judges waved off a number of associated complaints but conceded that authorities should have written the order into law before using the threat of police detention to keep people inside. It says, while there's no question that the requirement was a necessary, reasonable, proportionate response, to the COVID-19 crisis at the time, the requirement was not prescribed by law and was therefore contrary to Section 5 of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, the ruling ruled. The panel added that the initial lockdown curtailed certain rights and freedoms affirmed by New Zealand's Bill of Rights Act of 1990, including but not limited to freedom of movement, peaceful assembly, and association. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern ordered the citizens to remain in their homes on March 23rd, but the legislation reportedly wasn't written into law until April 3rd. Attorney General David Parker attempted to downplay the significance of the ruling, saying, "We always thought we were acting legally all the way through, but apparently you weren't." Meanwhile, New Zealand has delayed its general elections, passed a law allowing for warrantless property searches by police. Oh, then it's okay. And Prime Minister Ardern has said that openly that the people will be forced to remain indefinitely in military-guarded isolation hotels until they consent to COVID-19 testing. So basically, they acted outside the law, which is, I guess, illegal, right? And also unconstitutional, but there's no penalty for that because I guess the emergency was so bad. Of course, we talked last week that New Zealand announced that they were going to be detaining people in quarantine centers who test positive for COVID-19. These are infected citizens, as they say. Of course, in reality, we're all infected because we're all exposed. And so we all, when we take a test for these things, whether it's a PCR test or antibody test, we could be interpreted as being infected and positive just as easily it could be interpreted as not being infected. These tests are completely bogus, but nevertheless, they're relying on these tests to detain people. The government now in New Zealand says it has the power to kidnap people, extract people from homes, separate children from parents, and put them in quarantine centers for as long as 14 days or until they test negative. We talked about that last week. Again, all over what, you know, these are quarantine camps.
Yeah, and it's very frightening in that the PCR tests are so meaningless, and you could be put in a concentration camp, a family could be separated, and then you could not be permitted to leave because of the results of the PCR tests. I had read the article by Engelbrecht and Demeter, COVID-19 PCR tests are scientifically meaningless. I recommend it highly. These guys did a great job. And you know, Tim, I wanted to mention that I think kind of the background inspiration for the article that they produced is really John Rappaport, who they quote in their article. And you have to give a shout out to John because his work on AIDS helped us have a platform from which we could question and be skeptical about the science that was being force-fed of this worldwide epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the epidemic is so overwhelming, it seemingly, that if we didn't have John's work on AIDS raising the question, and not just his work, but his, you know, he compiled so many interviews with scientists who really showed that this idea that the AIDS virus was real was in fact scientism. There wasn't any real basis for the belief. It was just a general consensus of media-connected scientific representatives,
mm-hmm.
the government. And so because of John's work, I think people were able to get on the possibility that COVID was meaningless much earlier than we did with the AIDS storyline, which was, this is fantastic because obviously we need to debunk it now that they're using it for the both entry and exit of concentration camps. We really need to know the possibility that the test is meaningless. And so what's interesting, just to kind of paraphrase from this article that I was so influenced by, what's interesting is that no one has ever produced the necessary science to have a connection between the DNA strand which makes up the test,
mm-hmm.
and disease which they call COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very particular scientific process which creates what's called a gold standard, right? So that you know that if someone has this, that they are either infected, meaning they have an active disease, or they are going to become infected if they have it. But that has never been done with the DNA strands, which led up to the creation of the PCR. And this article, these guys were ingenious. One of the things they did was they got a lawyer, and they actually went through the lawyer and demanded an explanation from the companies who created the PCR test. And they got them to admit, they got each of the companies to admit that, well, we have never actually done the work to create a purified virus. So I don't want to get into the science of it because I think it'll put people to sleep. But
yeah, well, Kerry Mullis, guy who invented it, says it shouldn't be used for diagnosis.
Kerry Mullis, who invented this,
yeah.
this method, said this is not for detection.
Yet,
this is a manufacturing technology.
Yet they're using, just like with the AIDS test.
Yeah, exactly right. They misused it from the very beginning, and so now they created this. They created this storyline in the media that there was a relationship between this virus, this DNA, and infection, and people getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to know that the test is actually of the virus, you have to have it based on something. It has to have some kind of solid platform that you know that the DNA that you're doing this PCR test of is both related back to the virus and also that the virus goes forward and creates the infection. But they haven't done either one of these things. Neither one of these processes, which are well documented, were done. They simply, they admitted, the four companies that created the PCR test, which is used, admitted that they had never purified the virus. Now, that's absolutely critical step, because if you don't have what's called the gold standard to compare to, you don't have any idea of what you're actually linking up.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did was is they took micrographs or pictures of what they think may be a virus, but they didn't do the purification. And then beyond that, they never did the tests, and again, it's a very well-known scientific process to make sure that there is a relationship between the disease and the virus, right? So you have to have the two steps. You have to have make sure you know you're taking a picture of the actual virus, and you have to know that the virus causes the infection. Neither one of these things were done.
Well, yeah, they didn't say with PCR tests do multiple studies of 1,000 people who test positive for the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, and then are these people actually getting sick? Do they show any pathology?
Exactly. And let me tell you something. It would have been so easy to do, and it would be so easy to do. I'm actually trying to get people that I'm in communication with who are involved in large, hopefully large demonstrations, to bring this up as something that the people can demand. And actually, we can do it ourselves. So we don't even have to let the government. But we should do a double blind test, which is simply that if they claim, like the people they've locked up, have this disease, then they must be able to do a double blind standard, which is to say, we take three of these people compare that they have locked up, compare them, do their PCR test, get 97 people who have not been test positive, and then see if the government scientists can pick out the three who they have locked up. Because the fact is they couldn't. There isn't enough virus. See, here's the point. In order for it to be a disease, you have to have a very high viral load. It isn't enough to just detect a single cell, right? You have mm-hmm. to have a large viral load. But the standard of what is the viral load to create a sickness of the COVID sickness has never been determined.
It's never PCR just magnifies. It doesn't even count the viral load. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And so if you then looked at these people who they have locked up, right, waiting for their test results to clear, whatever they mean by that, then the government needs to be able to do a double blind to assure the public they didn't lock them up just for slave training. And we know for sure that the government couldn't do this, that they would never be able to succeed because, Tim, the virus does nothing to the general public beyond the baseline of all of like normal mortality.
Yes, that's assuming this thing actually exists as they claim.
Even, yeah. If it does or it doesn't, it isn't having any effect on the normal mortality. Yeah. There's only two times in the United States where you had explosions, and we'll talk about both of them. I mean, one of them we talked about quite a bit is when they murdered all the people in retirement homes in New York. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you, like that one month, you had like a lot of people beyond the normal baseline of mortality in the U.S. were killed or died. But that was just because Cuomo and Christie murdered all the people in the retirement homes. It had nothing to do with the virus. Well, it was just putting infected people by mandate into homes. It's a total breach of all protocol.
Well, Andrew Cuomo said himself, took credit for it at the Democrat National Convention, a virtual convention, for his handling. But then again, as the article you sent me, Governor Cuomo's taking the position that he can't be investigated because any investigation would be inherently political. So basically, no politician can ever be investigated for anything, any transgression, crime, or breach of law because it's inherently political. So if you want to get immunity from the law, just run for political office and get elected, and therefore, well, there's no way there can be any fair investigation in this.
but what I think is that certainly in the case of Cuomo's victims is you'll find that they were not infected with this COVID, and they couldn't produce blood work. They never have.
No.
Okay. So that's why I believe that they don't have it to produce. They would have if they could have. What they would find if they did what's called the C-reactive, they would find that this is bacterial pneumonia. It's one of the pneumonia strands. This is what they did. They took people who were had respiratory diseases, which typically means pneumonia.
Yeah, right? which could be toxic. It could be bacterial. It could be fungal. Anything. Yeah,
or bacterial. It could even be viral. But
yeah, or stress. Stress meaning that these microbes you have in you, they're relatively benign, but you put someone under stress and you're weakened. All of a sudden, they become malign. They create pathology. That's it's like. like scaring the hell out of old people and leaving them isolation and depressing them. That might weaken your immune system.
But and then
what, when you, whatever I, physical neglect they suffer, because they no longer have people looking after them. They no longer have family members visiting them.
When you do, and then on top of that, you mandate that the retirement home has to take in individuals who are highly infected with
yes.
pneumonia.
Yeah.
Now you're just going to get a huge body count, but they needed to do it to create the panic. And one thing that in looking at, I was looking at the history of the PCR and the COVID in the U.S., I could see that there was actually another time that they had done it to create hysteria, and that was at the very beginning with patient zero.
Mm-hmm.
So patient zero in the United States is a very interesting phenomena. It was someone who came off of a cruise ship, evidently in
yes.
Seattle, are prevalent in a cruise ship. They don't have, they don't give details on that, and they don't identify the individual. What they say is that he was in Wuhan, China, and then he made it back to Seattle. Now, this individual is supposed to be 35 years old, evidently didn't die, but for some reason, he went to the emergency room. Now, right off the bat, you can see the story is fake. This is a fake story, because if you look at the odds of someone who is 35 with COVID needing go to the emergency mm-hmm. room, 1 in 1,000. So already you've got something that's unbelievable in the story.
That's like that patient zero. Remember that back in the 80s, there was a story of a French Canadian. He was a flight attendant who would go around the gay bathhouses, and then he'd turn a light on and reveal his gay cancer to his people in the bathhouses and all that. It was a lurid story. But as we know, that wasn't, the idea of it being HIV virus and these things, which John Rappaport reports on in his book AIDS Incorporated. I mean, it's just one of these scary, patient zero. It's Hollywood,
So the patient zero now, because of the concern of COVID, was subjected to a they did a test on him, which is not really clear, because it's a little like there's a problem here of a chicken and an egg, but since it's a fake story, I guess they don't have to try to rationalize anything. But somehow they found that this guy was had COVID. Now, perhaps because he had been to Wuhan and there had been publicity, they were, and he has a respiratory illness. I mean, it kind of makes sense. But in any case, they said, well, we tested, we knew the 65 people that he met with. We did testing, and again, the PCR test hadn't been done at this point, so it's not clear. We don't know exactly what test they gave him, but they said none of these people had COVID, so that was the end of that, except for the fact that a week later in Lakeside Care Center, I believe it is, they had an outbreak. Now, this is 25 miles from anywhere this guy had been, but by some mysterious way, it got into the retirement home, and it just went, the disease went basically out of control. And you had, it wasn't just the patient, the old people were dying, but the aides were getting it. Even the ambulance driver, evidently, so you had this incredibly contagious disease, mm-hmm. right, that was loose, and people were dying left and right. And so this, seemed like the base, and this was this was the very first outbreak, and it occurred in February, late February, early March in Seattle. And it was because of this hysteria that had been created through this deaths and things that had occurred there. That's when you started getting this idea of locking us down. And in fact, if you go through what had happened at the Life Care call, it's the Life Care Center in Seattle, you can see that it was the same phenomena that occurred later on in New York and in New Jersey, they took a lot of these people and moved them out for some reason, even though this is completely a breach of retirement home protocol. They moved a number of these patients out who had respiratory problems to other places. And the next thing you know, you had a dozen retirement homes in Seattle that are all reporting on this. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the ways you can see that this is fake is not, now looking back, that the level of contagion, it was unrealistic. It doesn't happen in this way. It never has happened again. If it was this contagious, we'd have half the world dead by this point.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Instead of nobody. So anyway, you can see that there's something wrong with the story, but the way you can really see that the story is just bunk is that Life Care Center is at 120 Street in Kirkland, which is south of Seattle. I mean, Tim, it's right across the street from Bill Gates's offices. So, I mean, well, gee, what's the chances of that? So it just seems, given that Gates' relationship into this whole thing, that's very suspicious. And then you had the science that came out, which was saying this is very contagious, and you had guys on TV, that little graph showing all of the, they were tracing, where it had gone and how contagious the thing was and how it was going to kill everybody. And this all came from what's called the Hutchinson Center. Now, the Hutchinson Center is basically a wholly owned Gates Foundation device. I mean, it received $40 million to accelerate HIV vaccine development, Tim, in 2006. And it's been on the Gates, money train ever since. So, I mean, you can see that this is just a, you have to suspect the conflict is in existence there. So anyway, that led up to the creation of the PCR test, which they use this patient zero's, the COVID they found inside of him supposedly to make it. And then you had the WHO director, give the famous, we've got a test. He uses mm-hmm. that test. The British health minister came out and used the same expression, we have to test. And so suddenly the testing was seen as a way to, know how bad the COVID was going to be. But none of the science proving that the test was really meaningful had been done. We were just told to test. And everyone started to test. And then sure enough, hundreds and then thousands of people were testing positive. You then had the explosion of deaths because of the Cuomo murder machine in New York. And then the rest is history. But now the test is being used as the basis for, all kinds of, they're using it for everything, to justify the government lockdown. And so anyway, I'm hoping that, we can bring to light the fact that the test is not related to the disease. It related to possibly to a virus, but the relationship between the virus and the disease has never been proven. And now when you look at the mortality rates in the countries that have been supposedly plagued by this epidemic, Tim, they're just the same as they have been for the last 10 years.
If I understand, they're slightly off from last year. So there's lower numbers. So if we're in a pandemic, you would see a spike in deaths. And there's actually a slight drop. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they've obviously borrowed from other, other diseases and just called it COVID. And of course, that's kind of well known now, how they've been fudging the numbers with that, the comorbidity issue, that, and also dying with COVID as opposed to dying of it. Conflating the two, and there's all types of reasons why that is. There's all types of monetary incentives for the states and hospitals to do that with Medicaid or Medicare and through the CARES Act, and also the states getting funding. They get money for each COVID case, which is just a positive test. So what do you think they're going to produce? I mean, these tests are like rigged slot machines. Just patch it, press the lever, get the result you want. That's what they're doing. And also the whole idea that you have a disease, but within 10 or 11 weeks of it being announced, spreads to over 100 countries. That is indeed the case. Containment's not going to work anyway in the final analysis. The best strategy would be to natural herd immunity, get the vast majority of the public exposed to it, live with it, and life goes on. And that's, but there's reasons why that couldn't be permitted, because there's a secret agenda behind all this. One of the is the, of course, the Great Reset and the technocratic order that they want to create from the wreckage that they're creating through, under the pretext of the pandemic. And in order to continue with the wreckage and destruction, they need to maintain the fear, the terror, the aesthetic, if you will, the theatrics of it all. And that's what the shutdown was all about. That's why we're watching baseball games with no one in the stands, or cardboard effigies of fans in the stands. And we're seeing why movie theaters aren't open yet, and why colleges are being shut down. You can't have people having a normal life. Just like, I think UNC was open for a little while, and they were shocked at, students went there and went to parties where they weren't social distancing. So they went back to online classes, you know, and this is all part of this online learning, and just is getting people all conditioned to this stuff. You know, whether it's mask wearing, online learning, and, you know, the restrictions on churches. My diocese papers, every time you get it, it's all about COVID stuff and articles about COVID. It's kind of funny because for a few weeks it was about racism. And this is the Catholic Church. And I suspect the bishops were bribed to do this. You know, just the way they're bribed to be involved in weaponized migration. They're being bribed, you know, because that's the only way they're making up for their loss in contributions. I got a phone call from my parish last week. I didn't answer. I just heard the voicemail. It was asking if I'm still a member of the parish, because I haven't been to church, their church, since March. Because they shut it down, then they restricted. And if I'd answered the phone, I would have responded. I said, "Are you still a church? Are you still a parish?" You know, yeah. Well, no. What? Like, I'm sorry. I mean, you know, you shut everything down. You canceled Easter celebrations. You denied Catholics the sacraments for the better part of 2 months, and you're asking me if I'm still part of the parish. You know. Yeah. And they're playing the game. They're maintaining the narrative when they as they follow these restrictions. And as of now, I see the institution, those people in the, who are infested institutions, as the enemy now, and that goes all the way up to the hierarchy.
Now, okay. Yeah, and you know there have been some pretty good demonstrations in the U.S. Some of them with weapons, which I think was very important. Europe has had demonstrations, and looking at Melbourne and Auckland, you can see how important it was, because in those cities, they didn't have any demonstrations. They had been very peacefully going along the population, and so the government could then get out ahead with severe concentration camp type lockdowns, whereas in Berlin. We're hoping that they will be multi-millions on the 29th. Mm-hmm. And you can see the difference, because if you have the power of organizing that kind of a demonstration, you can't really set up concentration camps. The government, you see what I mean? The government really can't do that, because that will just then have the response of much larger citizen reaction. So the government has to take a different approach to the slave training. Whereas in Auckland and Melbourne, they're getting ahead of it. You know, they're now, I don't know if you saw the Masonic monster Prince Charles addressing the Australians.
No.
Did you see that? That was just so sick. It was almost, I had to turn the television off. I wasn't, he was online. I saw that. But anyway, yeah, he addressed the Australians and he said, you know, you're made of such tough stuff. I know you can do this. I know it's difficult, but I know that the Australians are made of tough stuff. And, you know, you have to just look at that in context of how many times the Masonic family has genocided. I mean, they set up Australia as a penal colony.
Yeah.
Right. And then they've used them as cannon fodder in every war, for heaven's sakes. You know, they sent them into the mustard gas, automatic weapons in Germany. They've just done, his family has been, basically around-the-clock genocidal operation against Australians for hundreds of years.
Yeah, Gallipoli, yeah.
Yeah, like at Gallipoli, where you get the expression diggers, you know, comes from. Well, okay, now he's sitting there saying, gee, we have so much respect for your toughness. And he's hoping that this line will play with the Australians.
As they cower in their homes, submitting to
Exactly.
their
I mean,
that's tough.
he's just telling them, that their cowardice is to be praised. I mean, this is so sad to see the Melbourne people reduced to believing into this just obvious and really just pitiful propaganda. They should be trying to lynch that evil, devil, but instead they're actually, in Melbourne there, it's as far as I can tell, there is some, I've gotten a few responses from people who are in Melbourne saying, we're trying, it's difficult because there's so much obedience. But I've also got some people who are afraid of the food situation. So we'll see how that plays out. But if we start getting, and I noticed last week you had major demonstrations. Mainstream media didn't cover it,
No.
which is a good sign. I mean, it means that they want to keep people from seeing this. Hopefully the events on the 29th will not just be in Berlin. I know they're trying to get other cities to participate, to force the media to cover it. And if they, it's sort of an interesting situation because if the government cracks down, if you get the military in there and you have millions of people, there's bound to be reportable violence, which I think would be impossible to keep out of, certainly out of the internet. And so from there, you might start having the population beginning to respond in general with anger. Hopefully that's the case because, I mean, what else can you offer the people of Melbourne and Auckland at this point but anger? You've got to get angry and start fighting back.
Well, yeah, it's almost like the rank and file have to change sides. Something that you saw like in Romania in 1989 or something, and they no longer have the means of coercion to impose these things. They lose support of the rank and file because the rank and file have to realize they're on the chopping block as well. I mean.
I mean, that's they have to they can only take the lockdown, the slave training so far when before they start really breaking minds and breaking bodies. And at that point, the public has a choice. I mean, is this a rational social policy, or are they just trying to kill me?
So, well, tonight main topic, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is a national public health institute in the United States. It is a United States federal agency, supposedly under the Department of Health and Human Services, and it is headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia. Its stated goal is to protect public health and safety through the control and prevention of disease, injury, disability in the United States and internationally. The CDC focuses national attention on developing and applying disease control and prevention. It especially focuses its attention on infectious disease, foodborne pathogens, environmental health, occupational safety and health, health promotion, injury prevention, educational activities designed to improve the health of the United States citizens. The CDC also conducts research and provides information on non-infectious diseases, such as obesity and diabetes, and is a founding member of the International Association of National Public Health Institutes. The Communicable Disease Center was founded on July 1st, 1946, as a successor to the World War II Malaria Control and War Areas Program of the Office of National Defense Malaria Control Activities. Preceding its founding, organizations with global influence in malaria control were the Malaria Commission, the League of Nations, and the Rockefeller Foundation. That's interesting. The Rockefeller Foundation greatly supported malaria controls, sought to have governments take over some of its efforts, and collaborated with the agency. The new agency was a branch of the U.S. Public Health Service in Atlanta and was chosen as a location because malaria was endemic to the southern United States. The agency changed names before adopting the name Communicable Disease Center in 1946. Offices were located on the sixth floor of the Volunteer Building on Peachtree Street. In 1947, the CDC made a token payment of $10 to Emory University for 15 acres of land on Clifton Road in DeKalb County, still home of the CDC headquarters as of 2019. CDC employees collected the money to make up the purchase. The benefactor behind the gift was Robert W. Woodruff, chairman of the board of the Coca-Cola Company. Woodruff had a long-time interest in malaria control, which had been a problem in areas where he went hunting. The same year, the PHS transferred its public health service, I guess, transferred its San Francisco-based plague laboratory into the CDC as the Epidemiology Division, and the new Veterinary Diseases Division was established. An Epidemic Intelligence Service was established in 1951, originally due to the biological warfare concerns arising from the Korean War. It evolved into a two-year postgraduate training program in epidemiology and a prototype for the field epidemiology training programs in numerous countries, reflecting the CDC's influence in promoting this model internationally. The mission of the CDC expanded beyond the original focus on malaria to include sexually transmitted diseases, with the Venereal Disease Division of the United States Public Health Service was transferred to the CDC in 1957. Shortly thereafter, the tuberculosis control was transferred to the CDC from the Public Health Service, and then in 1963, the immunization program was established. Since the 1990s, the CDC focus has broadened to include chronic diseases, disabilities, injury control, workplace hazards, environmental public threats, and terrorism preparedness. CDC combats emerging diseases and other health risks, including birth defects, West Nile virus, obesity, avian, swine, and pandemic flu, E. coli, bioterrorism, to name a few. Okay, so that's a rundown on the CDC, and also it's sort of the secretive, mysterious outfit, the EIS, the Epidemic Intelligence Service. So I'll let you take it from there, Joe.
Well, I mean, EIF is, it's been called the CIA of the CDC. It is responsible for finding the causes of infection breakouts in the United States. The research I did this week showed that it had failed in the most basic obligations of its responsibilities in the COVID disaster. And this was clearly done deliberately to foment hysteria, because they did not insist and oversee, because they were involved from the very beginning, the normal testing and blood work that would have given us, for example, some kind of baseline as to how much SARS virus is in the blood of someone who's infected, as opposed to someone who is asymptomatic. Now, that should have been done at the very beginning as a standard protocol, but it wasn't done here. In our case, this wasn't done. Moreover, they've never done any of the protocols to prove that there is a relationship between the virus and the disease. And this is actually a very well-known four-step process called Koch's theorem, I believe. It's gives this postulate that you have to do four things. Now, this is, I hope, you know, people aren't bored with this, but this is sort of important. You know, I mean, they're locking us down and putting us in concentration camps, so we know a little bit about the science that wasn't done. In the Koch postulate, you have to find the microorganism in disease but not healthy individuals. Okay, so that's the very first thing. That seems almost self-evident, right? That it has to be something that the sick people have and the healthy people don't. And then two, you have to be able to culture this microorganism from the diseased individual. And then three, inoculations of a healthy individual with the cultured microorganisms must end up with the disease occurring. And then the microorganism needs to be re-isolated from the inoculated individual and matched to the original organism. Okay, so the fourth step is kind of complicated, but the first three is just really straightforward. None of this was done. They haven't proved that there is this relationship, which would end up with, you would have a number, some kind of number where you'd have what is the difference between people who are diseased and sick with COVID and people who are not in terms of how much of this DNA appears in their blood. So since the postulates were never done, I am making the case and have tried to make the case to the people in Auckland. And I'm actually going to be doing a podcast in New Zealand next week, Monday or Tuesday. So hopefully I'll be able to get this information or this suggestion out.
You've actually been there, haven't you?
Many times. Yeah. And I was there last like a year ago, I think. And so I know a lot of people there, and I hope I can do this podcast and make this suggestion and see if I can, you know, make the people of Auckland aware of it, that they should be demanding that the test that has locked them down. And if you listen to the statement of the health minister and then the cackling witch, and I didn't know who it was last week, incidentally, the woman who gave this, we're going to, if you don't do your test, we're going to, that was Ardern, that was the prime minister who was actually making, I just described her as a cackling witch, which I guess was caught a number of people as an accurate description of her. But in any case, who incidentally, her background, Freemasonry, I mean, her dad, her education. So, you know, she's just a secret society member who's been put in this position. And so she's locked them down because, and she's using the PCR test as the basis for it. The people should say, look, if we are truly sick, right, then we should be able to do a double blind test. We should have 100 people, and we would be, you know, our work would be like our test would be the 17th, the 27th, the 50th, and you would have people who could pick us out from the healthy group. And that is the basis for why we should be here. Because if they can't do that, if they can't actually do Cox postulates and actually identify a sick person, you know, with this disorder, then what in the world are we doing being locked down? What is the point of it? I mean, the idea that we would infect people with what? For what? I mean, if we are not sick and we cannot be detected, and there's nothing about us that was different than healthy people, what is the legal basis for us being in the concentration camp? And since the tests are so unreliable, I mean, because the test is really just for this strand since it is not basically detecting something that leads to an overwhelming illness and has, you know, massive amount of replication in someone's body, you have constant false positives, right? Because it's just, this virus can blink in and out of someone's body. Evidently, it can be detected one week, not the next. So if you're in the camp and you test and you test positive, they just keep you there. Mm-hmm. And they test it 2 weeks later, they test you again, you're still positive. Well, I mean, what does the positive mean? What is it actually related in terms of either contagion or in terms of sickness?
Yeah, what if you're asymptomatic?
So they need to get... If you're asymptomatic, right? So they need to show the infection kind of storyline that they've given the people of Auckland is that there was a boat, it came in on the boat, 25 people got it, or, you know, they have some storyline.
Right, that's the contagion narrative, yeah.
That's right, and it's just like going back to patient zero and. You know, in Kirkland,
which is just a pretext for imposing these restrictions.
That's right. But there's no sick people. I thought I'd read last week, and I mentioned that if there was someone had died, and then I was corrected. The someone in Auckland kind of got home. He said no one's died. There hasn't been any deaths. Well, where are the sick people?
And it goes back to the basic question: you have a disease which has a lethality for healthy people of, you know, well below 1%. So why the alarm?
Well, right. And if you have sick people, which they claim they do, okay, so you have sick people, then they have to be able to be detected in a double blind test.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you cannot use your test and detect the five people and putting them into a double blind test with, say, other 95 people. And then the people who are looking at this, these test results say, I know who the five are. Here they are. Patient 18, patient 30, patient 30. If they can't do this, they don't have any basis, no scientific basis, let alone legal basis, to keep these people incarcerated.
It's not incarceration. It's quarantine.
Oh, right. You're right.
Highly incentivized voluntary quarantining.
But not very voluntary.
Well, it is, because they say it is.
I guess you're right.
So
I guess the people of Melbourne are all voluntarily locked down. And if they want to go to the adjoining borough, they need to voluntarily get a permit to do so.
Even mask wearing is voluntary. If you don't want to get strangled by a police officer, you put a mask on.
Yeah, I saw another video of like a guy walking down the street. He wasn't on right, and he got
on right.
Yeah, and they're definitely using kind of Gestapo. I mean, it's like I guess more like Stasi, they're using high levels of violence and then putting it on TV just to have, so that everyone knows that if you mouth off, you're going to get smacked. And see, this is why you need large demonstrations, because if you've had a demonstration in Melbourne of like 2 million people, the police can't walk around and smack people because the mask is not on right. You see that how fundamental the citizens' participation in democracy really is?
Mm-hmm.
Because if that happened, if you had millions of people, then the public who were passerbys, right, who saw this, they wouldn't stand.
This is why the right to peaceful assembly is enshrined in the Constitution. And supposedly should be respected. Whether you pass a law or a mandate, does that supersede the Constitution? Last time I checked, you need a supermajority to amend the Constitution. I'm not sure what the law is in New Zealand, but this is why you assemble, so you have strength in numbers, so you can't be easily intimidated. You know, if you isolate and atomize people, you can intimidate the individual rather easily. And that's the strategy.
Yeah.
But I mean, it gets back to this infectious disease narrative, which is used because with an infectious disease that has to be chased down, you need a intelligence service to track these down, like they track down terrorists or communists. So you need an intelligence service to outwit them and always on the guard. It makes all of us potential agents of this dreaded disease. So we all become suspicious of one another, and we also have to submit to these restrictions, be they, restrictions to move about, to earn a living. Even you can't even resist a jab, because now they have to monitor you, and they have to inject, nanotechnology in you to monitor your health, because your health affects everyone else. So that becomes a pretext for this, this 1984 Panopticon situation. And you also create a situation where the Panopticon is where the prisoners will inform on the other prisoners. And so the state itself doesn't have to have people enforcing, because they have people themselves enforcing this stuff, because they've been so terrorized or brainwashed into thinking that there's a real problem out there. But, it's been, like you said, it refers, the EIS has been referred to as the medical CIA. And, of course, the CDC was formed in 1946, not too long before the CIA was formed. And of course, they developed the Epidemic Intelligence Service in response to a crisis, the Cold War. And it's the same, that was the same pretext for the CIA. So this agency and the CDC and the EIS developed around the same time. But John Rappaport does a good take on the EIS, the Epidemic Intelligence Service. He says, basically it's the medical CIA, CDC agents run what he calls global covert ops. And their idea is to go out and find a virus, or say they found a virus that's a cause of some sort of outbreak or some sort of disease, contagion or problem. And that you find a virus, then you cover up the real causes, which might be toxic, dumping of toxins, or it could be a civil war that's resulted in famine when you have diseases, or it could be polluted water in these things. But you find a virus, and this is what some people think what the origins of the attempted swine flu epidemic of 2009 was. It related back to a huge pig farm in Mexico that was full of, you know, wasn't maintained. It didn't have a decent drainage. Had a huge feces and urine pool there, so it didn't have decent drainage. So that, you know, you had this disease develop. You put a pig in a pen, you know, tens of thousands, 100,000 pigs in a pen, you know, snout the butt. Yeah, they're going to get sick, and then you're going to call it a virus. You know, it's like, no, it's like they're sick because of corporate farming, and the people working there are getting sick too. But you blame a virus as opposed to the toxic chemicals they're exposed to. And so that's what the sort of the function, what he says that the EIS serves. But he describes it this way. The Scouts are the CDC's little-known epidemic intelligence service. They create disinformation on a scale that must make the CIA jealous. Graduates of the EIS program are proudly stated by the CDC, have gone on to occupy key positions in the overall medical cartel. Surgeons general, CDC directors, medical school deans, professors, medical foundation executives, drug company and insurance executives, state health officials, medical editors and reporters, and media outlets, power at key junctures. So they control the narrative, and they all come from the same mindset. It's a loyal insiders club. They collaborate to float prime cut a prime number one cover stories of extraordinary dimensions. They invent medical reality out of thin air. Here's a brief excerpt from the CDC 50 Years of Epidemic Intelligence Service. This was published in 2001. In 1951, the EIS was established by the CDC following the start of the Korean War as an early warning system against biological warfare and man-made epidemics. EIS officers selected for two-year field assignments were primarily medical doctors and other health professionals who focused on infectious disease outbreaks. EIS has expanded to include a range of public health professionals such as postdoctoral scientists in statistics, epidemiology, microbiology, anthropology, sociology, behavioral sciences. Since 1951, approximately 2,500 EIS officers have responded to requests for epidemiologic assistance within the United States and throughout the world. Each year, EIS officers are involved in several hundred investigations of disease and injury problems, enabling CDC and its public health partners to make recommendations to improve public's health and safety. Several hundred investigations a year, an unparalleled opportunity to shape truth into propaganda. Control of information about disease, control out in the field, where EIS agents rush to the scene of outbreaks, send their pronouncements back through the hallowed halls of academia and the CDC, into the press, into big pharma, into multiple government agencies. Control of information means disinformation. That's what the EIS is for. They've never met a virus they didn't love, and if they didn't find one, they pretended they did. They front for the medical cartel, and they provide cover for the crimes of mega corporations. There's a town where poverty-stricken people are dying because of horrendous pesticides or running into the water supply and soil. No, it's a virus. There's a city where the industrial pollution is driving people over the edge into immune system failure. No, it's a virus. Wuhan is a good example of that. The terrible air condition, terrible conditions of the air there, the pollution there, where they report 300,000 deaths a year, just to pneumonia. And here's the capper: their propaganda is so good, most EIS people believe it themselves. You don't achieve that kind of robotic servitude without intense brainwashing. The first installment of mind control program is called medical school. The EIS would have you believe the whole world is being attacked by viruses all the time. That's their mission. And of course, this strengthens the vaccine establishment, because for every virus, there ought to be a vaccine, a shot in the arm, loaded with toxic chemicals and a variety of germs. The EIS is CDC's brand of brothers, the medical CIA.
Right. And it's good that you brought up that the broad stroke of how EIS controls the narrative. It has placed its officers everywhere inside the American medical establishment. You couldn't do this COVID scam without controlling medical schools. I mean, think of when you read the list of organizations it controls, basically all of the way that information can get to the public, they are able to manipulate. Mm-hmm. And that's why you just cannot take any of the medical establishment as an honest source of information. I don't know if you saw, like, it was last week, you had three doctors. They had an article that, saying that, you need to require a COVID vaccination for everyone. It's not un-American. In fact, it's patriotic. I don't know if you remember that, but it was three doctors, and there was Letterman, Mehlman, and Younger. I mean, I went into the background of these guys. They're all spooks, and they all come from the same organization, which is actually like a business school that somehow they've gotten involved with. But that school is funded by Bill Gates. I'm serious. And then if you look in the background, like Younger, which is another odd thing, is they're all Jews. I thought this was strange. I mean, you wonder if that kind of, there is a little bit of a too much sort of in-club organization here. Younger is actually, Stuart Younger is one of the three doctors. His father was with the polio vaccine. He was on Salk's team that gave us the polio vaccine that led to so much trouble. So,
This is
I guess,
General Salk who experimented on people.
This, his father was in that team, and anyway, and so Mehlman is not a doctor. He's one of them. They call it three doctors. Actually, only two of them were doctors. One is Mehlman is not, but he's a Rhodes Scholar, for heaven's sake. So he's at Oxford Freemason. I mean, it just, you look at these guys and you go, holy cow, you can't trust them. And then the context of information like that, in that you establish with the EIS, so much personnel into the areas where you'd get information then disseminated into the public. Gee, Tim, thank heavens for the alternative media, huh? Because we have, as a people, we have been just living in a world of propaganda without hardly anyone knowing it for decades, and that's led to the situation now where they think they can genocide us, and we're going to have a happy face about the whole thing because we just are doing what the doctors tell us to do.
And people are still trained to look at an outfit like the CDC or the World Health Organization or the NIH to, as these are official bodies, institutions. They speak with authority. They have governmental power behind them. They have big buildings and they wear white coats and they got big budgets. So they must be pretty smart and they must be looking out for our best interest. That isn't the case, particularly with the CDC, because if you just scratch the surface, you see corruption. Very quickly. And Robert F. Kennedy has done some, research on vaccines and these things, but also on the CDC itself. And he wrote that the CDC owns what 57 different vaccines, patent. He has patents on these 57 different vaccines and profits about more than $4 billion a year from vaccine sales. So how can it be entrusted to oversee this? I mean, they obviously there's a conflict of interest.
It's ridiculous. And to not even mention the conflict when it makes these pronunciations backing up the mandates. So it's just a kind of medical tyranny. I mean, they're using the medical industry because it has this image in the minds of Americans as being something that's beneficial, something, they're thinking of the Hippocratic Oath or something, whereas it's actually just an enslavement, or
Well,
the whole.
they think it's objective, it's scientific,
Yeah.
it's not political, it's apolitical, they think. So that's what John Rapoport says is it's the medical cartel's most dangerous because it has this veneer of being apolitical, being neutral, and it's anything but. And it's tied into this to big pharma, the industry, and the financial powers that rule the world. And they're using this is one angle that they're using to impose a tyranny and maximize profits. They're trying to turn a $30 billion a year industry into a $100 billion a year industry, and also using that as leverage to impose greater controls. And one of the things is everyone getting shots every year, and denying all the baleful effects on public health that these jabs have
Well,
created. I mean,
I mean the vaccine that they're trying to get everyone prepared to take is not even a vaccine. It is a genetically modifying chemical system that just gets at your DNA. mean, it's not a classic vaccine. It's not the the so-called DNA vaccine, DNA RNA vaccines. They simply are genetic modifications.
Yeah, and the fact that they're talking about mandating it or highly incentivizing, as they say, means that most people are skeptical, don't want to take it. They'll take their chances. They have their immune system. And one thing is all these public health, the CDC is talking about like things like obesity and all that. Well, why don't they, instead of promoting toxic jabs, how about like going after the food supply system, how we eat, diet, and the lifestyle? You know, that's something, exactly. You know.
Well, the thing is those are achievements of the organization.
Yes.
The fact that we're fat and stupid, that's what they've been working on for decades. So they would never, you know, find a way around that. That is the actual achievement. But, you know, we were talking before we started the show, and we were saying, you know, it's actually good that the crisis has occurred, because we were headed for extinction anyway, if it had just gone on. The fact that we are now at this crossroads, and that the rationale that the oligarchs are giving is so preposterous, and I think so far ahead of really where they needed to be in terms of the enslavement and the genocide, they're waking people up. Mm-hmm. And now there is a chance we can organize ourselves against them. Because when you look at if you just, you know, go through the EIS and the individuals and where they are, and then look at their response to COVID, you see, it's like a litmus test. It has shown not just incompetent, but malevolence. How malevolent and organized and evil the medical industry is, because it has permitted this fake, unscientific virus to be the rationale to lock down and take away all of the freedom of the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're really dealing with a small organization that wants world power and is using very clever techniques to achieve it. But the fact that everyone can now see that the narrative about COVID was wrong. Well, that could never happen if the medical industry wasn't malevolent.
It could
never happen.
That's the function of like of an Anthony Fauci or a Deborah Birx or even this Julie Gerberding, who was the head of the CDC for several years, and she apparently oversaw its modernization. But she fast tracked the Gardasil vaccine, which has caused so much damage. Is now is the question. I think the target of many of a lot of investigation. I don't know if there's any lawsuits yet, but here's the corruption here. She leaves the CDC and she's given a cozy job at Merck, who manufactured the Gardasil vaccine.
So you can't sue them because it's all protected, you know, mm-hmm. by the hush-hush vaccine regulation.
But that revolving door is so obvious. I mean, she fast-tracks it, and she goes to work for the company that approved it, rather.
William Thompson, you know, the guy who whistle-blew, you know,
Bill Thompson, yes, yeah.
Yeah, he said, look, you know, the two people that I wrote the paper with who all knew the data was fake, they both got million-dollar jobs for Merck and...
She covered that scandal with the MMR vaccine. He was the whistleblower who talked to how they covered up the fact that it was causing increased rates of autism, particularly in black males, black boys. And Julie Gerberding covered that up, that scandal.
So this isn't this, you know, as we sit here, you know, kids with autism, the obesity, the diabetes, and now the lockdown, it's all coming from the same group. It's all basically their attempt at world domination. It's now not really hidden. It's kind of out in the open. A lot of people that I've been talking to who are involved in the protests in Europe, they just speak about this stuff openly. They don't have any confusion at all about who it is, what they're, and how deeply infested, you know, here's the infestation in their political world this group has gotten.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans know who is actually running the German government. So when you see these demonstrations that are going to get massive, I believe, boy, you know, let's hope we get them in the U.S. as well, because they are ways to get the public to start questioning. You know, that it's a hard way to learn a lesson, you know, with street fighting, you know, but when they see it and they see the government response and they start realizing that the people who are being beaten up, paying the blood price, are sincere and the rationale the government gives is nonsensical, well, maybe we can start getting a larger and larger fraction. Maybe it just won't be 10% of the public in the streets. Maybe it'll get to be 40, 30, 50% of the people. Mm-hmm. Then we'll see. Then we'll see if we can topple some of these fake governments. Because the governments are illegitimate. They're just absolutely illegitimate. They could never, someone like Cuomo, Gavin Newsom, you know, these people, they could never function inside a government that was actually related to, you know, expressing the democratic will of the people. This whole thing is fake. It's all just done for control so they can genocide everyone. And it's obvious now it's fake, right? It's just obvious. You know, they had that one bulge of mortality in April because of all killing all the people in retirement homes. But now the disease is just, it's mirroring just a normal year mortality and with the same amount of, you know, respiratory diseases and things. There's nothing unusual about the statistics in any of these countries. It's fake. There's no justification for the lockdown except for genocide, and people are starting to get it, I think.
Yeah, hopefully more will and, you know, mass consciousness. And then it all comes down to people just not complying anymore. And if you,
that's right.
You still have a psychology of compliance to, you know, bald face, you know, arbitrary, capricious rules not based on any science. Obviously, in many sense, I mean, they're anti-science and they're actually bad for you. Not like wearing a mask doesn't make you healthy, doesn't prevent you. It actually can make you sick. Not to mention the psychological effects of all these things you're having, the distancing and these things. And they've shut down the fabric of life is being torn asunder by this. People's livelihoods. I was listening to a doctor talk about like theater companies. There are people who can't do their theater shows. They can't. This is their social life. This is how they bet their spouses. This is how this is how they relate to people. This is what they do, and they can't do it. And this is leading to depression. This is leading to putting strain on marriages because people are feeling anxious. They're upset. Kids can't play sports program. You know, kids
how about all the young people who can't meet one another and establish relationships?
Yeah, another. I hear this like there's
like you know 20 and 35 that want to establish relationships, and their social life is now just shut down.
Yeah, I've heard that there's underground parties now. And Chris,
well, hopefully there are. Yeah, I hope. Yeah. Let's hope that there are. And hope. See.
And I've also heard about the economy is that a lot of people now are just going back to work. It's not being reported. And this is something where this will actually breathe life into the economy. This is how, again, how they can try to control the situation. As people are just now ignoring it, they're just not talking about it, and they're responding dynamically to the new dispensation, the new rules. But they're breathing just by getting around the rules and functioning. Obviously, there's a huge cost to this because this raises transaction costs. It creates inefficiencies that wouldn't really be there, not for the lockdown rules and restrictions. But people are finding ways, and that's not being reported on, which may mitigate the effects of the lockdown, the economic effects. But the point is, you know, if you're at some point, people are going to say, the heck with it, this whole thing is a scam. And we need to be done with it, and you all need to go. And that's
the key thing.
Yeah,
is that they have to start looking at the lockdown as a scam, and a really, really malevolent one. They can't, you know, they can't come to the idea that, you know, Gavin Newsom and Cuomo are bad people. They have to make the transition to understand that these are genocidal maniacs. Who are wanting to kill you and your family.
They're not stupid. They're evil.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like they're not that stupid.
They're not that stupid.
Yeah.
So they're just evil. We have evil in control of the political system, and we aren't going to get back, you know, I'd say, you know, the new normal. The new normal is genocide.
Yeah,
we're not going to get back to having a future unless we get rid of the evil. We have to.
The function of this operation, at least one of the functions is, or purposes of it is, they're identifying political figures who are willing to, you know, occasionally, you know, to kill proles or kulaks, and then then they realize these political figures are our type of guy or a type of gal, whether it's a Whitmore or a Cuomo or a Newsom, and they'll be rewarded within the system. And that's what people have to realize. That's what the system is kind of like now. That's the system doesn't represent you. I mean, we have elections. We have this weird election this year, weird conventions and these things. That stuff is largely just, a window dressing. And really what's going on behind the scenes, and the typical middle-class American who's trying to maintain his standard of living and support his family, he's watching the ground move underneath his feet, not knowing, you know, where to go because of this. Because he's still seeing this in terms of normal right-left political paradigm. It's not. It's beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, people send me email criticizing, you know, saying, well, you know, Joe, you're not giving organizational kind of outlines. You know, they need to, you know, have this kind of training for if they're going to look. We are at the end of the rope here. This is desperation. We have to act desperately. We just have to trust if we do rebel that we will find a way to organize at the same time. And if we don't, we just go down fighting. Mm-hmm. That's just too bad. But we have to fight back. And you can really see it in now that, they had a huge demonstration in Madrid. They certainly have, you know, in Berlin. And I think you'll see in those cities where the demonstrations are basically uncontrollable, that the people find a way to organize against the government. It's the first step is taking control of the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've been trying to get people to vet all of the leaders. You know how I am about DNA testing. Make sure you've got real people you can trust at the top. But, you know, I was listening to James Corbett, this thing he did, and he was just saying, look, you know, this is the time. I mean, if you let them vaccinate you with their genetic modification, it's the end of the road. So this is it. We are just backs against the wall. We have to fight back. Simple as that. Mm-hmm. We have to get in the streets. We have to stop complying, right? We're afraid, you know, where the demonstrations are massive, they won't need to wear masks the next day. The police will not try to enforce that kind of crap if they've seen millions of people in the street. They're human beings too. And when they see that kind of power, they will respond. They will, the police in Melbourne, if they had, you know, 500,000 people and 25,000 of them suddenly started throwing bricks at the cops, you'd see the next day, you wouldn't have the cops walking around smacking people in the head because their mask wasn't on right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's little steps like that you have to take. And then from that point, you can start to assemble. At this point, we can't even assemble to discuss who will lead us and what are the paths going to be. We have to take back that right. The first right is the right of assembly. We got to get that back.
Yeah, yeah.
Back to the churches. We have to get back to the social organization. We have to get back to the public square.
Yeah, we've assembled and we've determined you're illegitimate.
That's right.
So leave. You know.
Yep.
It was like, you know, you've been here far too long to have done any good. Leave this place now. So, you know, so go. Just go.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, they deserve the fate of the typical one when you have a revolution.
Yeah,
and they are not legitimate politicians. They don't deserve any legitimate legal process.
Well, six separate.
What they should do if they see the will of the people heading toward freedom and democracy, they should get out of the country at once.
Well, it's six semper tyrannis, thus they're all tyrants. It's a warning.
Exactly. A great slogan.
We're giving you a warning. We're giving you a warning.
Yeah.
You know. So when you're hanging from the lamppost, don't blame me.
Newsom and Cuomo, these guys, they should, if they see it turning, they should be smart enough to get out, because they by being the the figurehead of evil, when the public turns, they will be the, you know, the first ones they go after. They should. They, you know, get out of the country now.
Mm-hmm. So you go to your, whatever island you all go to now for your fun. So
I'm sure there's a country that will take them in.
Yes. So, okay, Joe.
All right, Tim. Well, we'll get them next week. It's going to be interesting. This will be an interesting week because the, you know, the 29th will be the day after we do our show on Friday. So it'll be interesting to see what goes on between now and then.
Yeah.
Let's just hope that people start to rise up.
Hopefully so. Okay. Good night then.
I'd love to talk to you.
Bye. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.